Okay, let's make a real start now. It's 11:15. Thank you again to Ellie for organizing and for inviting me. It's an honor to be speaking here. This is the third out of three different subjects. We talked about a few different things. The first one was Kavod HaBriyot. The second one was art, aesthetics, and Judaism. And now we have a topic that people used to be very interested in, but I think has slightly gone off the ball a little bit, off the boil, I should say, over the last few years. But it's something that's never very far away as an issue, which is the question of land for peace. And a few interesting halachic and hashgafic angles on that that we can bring together in this class. Now, let me assure you at the very beginning that I'm not interested in giving you my political opinions. I'm sure you're not interested in hearing them. I'm not in favor of rabbis speaking outside their area of expertise on whatever issue, certainly not on politics, unless they happen to be politicians, which of course many rabbis are. But I'm not in favor of rabbis talking about science if they don't really know about science, or politics if they don't really know about politics. So you won't get any personal political perspectives from me, but you will hopefully see a number of different angles on this particular issue. I have no idea what the political positions are of the people in this hall, although based on a demographic statistic, the chances are there are more right-leaning than left-leaning people here, but I'm not assuming that, and it's not relevant for the purpose of today's shiur. What we do need to do, however, before we start, is get a little bit of background and history, just so that we're on top of exactly where we are and how we got here. Now, many of you in this hall are a little bit older than me. I'm only 46, so my knowledge of these things goes back to the 1970s, but no further. Some of you will remember before the 70s a little bit, but it's worthwhile just to recap and work out how we got here. The current situation that we're in, politically, of course, was the creation of events of 100 years ago. 100 years ago, the First World War removed the Ottoman Empire, which had been in this part of the world for 400 years. And for 400 years, all of the land which we call Eretz Yisrael had been ruled by the Ottomans. During the First World War, the Ottomans were defeated by the Allies, by the British and the French and the Russians. After the war, the Russians kind of dropped away from the picture after the revolution, but after the war, the British and the French decided what they were going to do with the former Ottoman Empire. And they divided it up into rather artificial blocks, countries that they created, and they said, right, we'll each look after one and we'll work out what to do with it. France got Syria, Lebanon, Britain got Iraq, and Palestine. Palestine was an area of land which was defined as being what is now the country of Israel, including the land on the west bank of the Jordan, Yehuda v'Shomron, and also the land that we now call Jordan. All of that was called Palestine. And the British had a mandate on that from 1917, when General Allenby came in, and after the First World War, in the San Remo Conference, after the war in 1922, they decided what they were going to do with that. Now, in the interim, of course, in 1917, the Balfour Declaration had been issued, which had promised the Jewish community. It was issued, of course, by Lord Balfour to sent as a letter to Lord Rothschild in London. And the text of the Balfour Declarations promised the Jewish community that they would have a national homeland in Palestine. In Palestine. The original wording, you should know, of the Balfour Declaration was that Palestine would be the national homeland of the Jewish people. That wording was changed, largely at the request of British Jewish community, actually, who tried to water down the Balfour Declaration. I don't like to speak badly about the British Jewish community and all the individuals involved are long gone. But the British Jewish community were very nervous about their own situation vis-à-vis the British government, and they watered down the Balfour Declaration so that actually, rather than promising the Jews Palestine as a homeland, they were promised a homeland in Palestine. Now, shortly after the First World War, the area on the east bank of the Jordan, which originally Chaim Weizmann and others were hoping would be part of Eretz Israel, of the whatever state we would have, of course that was Eber HaYarden, which was originally part of Eretz Israel, that land was very quickly given away to the Hashemites. King Abdullah assisted in the First World War in various ways, the British government, and therefore the British government turned around to the Jewish community and says, forget about that, you're not getting that, that land is called Jordan, we're giving that to the Hashemites and that's off the table. What's left on the table is the land on the west bank of the Jordan, from the Jordan to the Mediterranean. That's what we can talk about. Now, as you well know, the British government did not manage to make any kind of deal with the British community, with the Jewish community, in what was then Palestine. Of course, the word Palestinian was almost entirely used in those days for the Jewish community. The Jewish community had Palestinian stamps in their passports. The Arabs didn't wish to be known as Palestinians in those days, because they wished to be known as Arabs, with a more pan-Arab association. But the British government didn't manage to make it work, and as you know, the Jews and the Arabs fell out very badly in 1929, 1931, etc. And eventually the British government gave up. They gave the whole problem back to the United Nations, or to the United Nations, which was newly formed after the Second World War, and said, we can't work it out, you work it out. The United Nations, in November 1947, issued a partition plan and said, okay, this is how it's going to be. There are going to be two homelands here, one for the Jews and one for the Arabs. And they partitioned it up. I haven't brought you a map, but I'm sure you can envisage the map. The Jewish area was going to be basically the coastal strip, a large part of the Negev. We're going to get lots of sand all the way down to Eilat. And up near, a little bit near the Tiberia and the Galil, but large parts of what is now Israel were not part of that partition plan. The whole of the middle part of the country, parts of the Galil, parts of the south, west of the country near Gaza, they were designed to be an Arab homeland. Now, as you well know, the partition plan was rejected by the Arabs in 1947. The Jews accepted it as at least some better than nothing, and from 1947 until now, we've been effectively at war on and off with different people about the fact that we can't agree on where to draw the borders. Okay? In 1967, the land which we now call Yehuda v'Shamron, which we always call Yehuda v'Shamron or the West Bank, I'm not getting into the political issues as to what you call it, was taken by the Israeli army. Was captured by the Israeli army in 1967. All the area from in Shechem and Jenin, all the way down Beit El, etc., Yerushalayim, down to Hebron. This was captured by the Israeli army, including the Golan and, of course, Gaza as well, and Gaza. And from 1967 up until today, there has been a discussion in every Israeli government as to what to do about this land. At the very beginning, the clear intention of Levi Eshkol's government in 1967 was to give this land away as part of a peace proposal. Moshe Dayan famously said he was waiting for a telephone call. Well, the telephone call never came, and they were waiting a long time, and this proposal, this idea of giving this land away, or at least parts of this land, for a comprehensive peace plan, never actually happened. Just to recap you on the governments that we've had since then, Levi Eshkol's government lasted, he actually died in office in the late 60s. Golda Meir took over from Levi Eshkol. Again, the same idea was to give away large parts of this land for a peace settlement. Peace, of course, certainly didn't come under Golda Meir because we had the Yom Kippur War. After Golda Meir, who had to resign at the end of that, Rabin took over at the end of her tenure. And he was then ousted in 77 by Begin. Once Begin got in, everybody thought there'll never be a peace plan now. But of course they were wrong, because Begin was the one who did a peace deal with Sadat and gave away the Sinai and Sharm el-Sheikh and all those areas, Yamit, etc. You'll probably remember that. He gave that to Sadat in exchange for a peace deal, which surprised everybody on the left that the right could do a peace deal, and surprised everyone on the right that the peace deal would hold, which it kind of has over the last 30 years, depending on your perspective. So the area in the Yehuda v'Shomron still was not part of a deal. Begin came, Begin went. In the 1980s, the governments were, if you remember back then, a sort of switch around between Yitzhak Shamir and Shimon Peres. That kind of switch on, switch off government that we had throughout the 80s. And of course, at the end of the 80s, we ended up with what they call now the First Intifada. Before us, I was in yeshiva then during that period in the late 80s. There was a lot of stuff going on, and there was a lot of pressure building to do some kind of a deal. Shamir was not a person that wanted to do that deal. He sat on his hands and did a good job of keeping the status quo going, but not taking it any further. And in 1992, Rabin took over. And of course, that led to what we now remember as being the Oslo Peace Accords. with Bill Clinton and Rabin and Yasser Arafat smiling on the lawn of the White House, and then Rabin and Shamir and the Arafat holding their Nobel Peace Prizes happily together. You remember the pictures, all the pictures of this. Of course, Rabin was assassinated in 1995, and Peres briefly took over, but was quickly ousted by Benjamin Netanyahu in his first government. He actually pushed this process forward. He signed, if you recall, the Y Accords to try and push Oslo forward, Oslo 1, Oslo 2, Oslo 3, etc. And that plan of having a two-state solution remains and remains in place. Netanyahu was kicked out by Ehud Barak. Ehud Barak very quickly tried to push this forward and do a comprehensive deal in the year 2000. That was really on the table then. The whole Land for Peace debate became very vocal then, because Barak made a very broad offer to Arafat of enormous amounts of land, including East Jerusalem, including Har HaBayit, etc., which Arafat rejected, to the surprise of everybody at the time. And then they broke out the second intifada. Ehud Barak was quickly swept aside by Ariel Sharon, who again, as a right winger, was expected never to do anything unpredictable, but of course did. It is interesting to look back on the history of this country, that all the major military victories against the Arabs have been won by the left-wing governments, and all the major land compromises have been done by right-wing governments. It's interesting how that works. But Ariel Sharon, of course, instituted the disengagement plan, the Hitna Kut, from Gaza, and that land was given to Fatah and quickly fell in the hands of Hamas. And then he collapsed and was sick. It took taken over by Ehud Olmert, who lasted a couple of years before being overrun, if you like, by Netanyahu, who has been ever since. The official policy of the government is still, as it really has always been, including under Menachem Begin, to do a deal of some kind with Yehuda v'Shomron. That has always been the policy of every government since 1967, and therefore to give away land in order to make peace. And I want to look today at whether what the perspectives have been of the different poskim and leaders of the Jewish community since 1967 on that particular issue. And we'll see a few different attitudes to this. Some of them were very controversial at the time. I remember some of these statements. We'll have a look at them now. We have quite a lot to do, so let's start. In terms of halakha, one of the overriding questions that we have to ask is, do we have a mitzvah, and maybe even a chiyuv, an obligation, to live in, to conquer, and to settle Eretz Israel? Because if the answer to that question is yes, then we're going to have to justify with some difficulty how that we're not going to do that mitzvah. But if the answer to that is no, we honestly don't have a chiyuv to do that, then the question is going to become very different. Well, why are we not allowed to give away land for peace if indeed there is no chiyuv to live in Eretz Israel? And on the contrary, if there's a pikuach nefesh angle, if we're going to actually save lives in the long run, why would you possibly object for such a thing? So that's a very important question to start with. Look at number one, please. There's a pasuk in Bamidbar, "V'harashtem et ha'aretz." So God says to the Jewish people, "You will conquer the land, v'yishavtem ba, and you will live in it. Ki lachem natati et ha'aretz l'reshet otah, because I've given you the land to dwell in." Now, what is that? Is that a mitzvah? Is that a tzivui? Is that a command? Is that one of the tariag mitzvahs? Or is that just a prediction, a promise that now you're going into the land? Don't worry. You don't have to worry about not succeeding, because I'm promising you that you will conquer the land and you will succeed. That is a question that many people have looked at, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. There is no question that Eretz Israel, and I don't need to bring sources to prove this, but I just brought a couple, is absolutely central to the Jewish people's hashkafah, no matter what position they take on this issue. If you look in number two, Rabbi Chiya bar Gamra, Midgid ba'Afra, he would roll in the dust when he got to Eretz Israel, and he'd quote a pasuk, "Ki ratzu avadecha es avaneha," because your servants so love the rock, even the rocks of Israel, "Bet Afra yechoneinu," and even the dust of Israel. Many people have fallen on their knees and kissed the ground, Rav Kook, others, when they reached Israel. Look at number three, a very poignant source, "Ma'aseh b'Rabbi Yehuda ben Pasei, Rabbi Maxia ben Cheresh, Rabbi Chanina ben Achi, Rabbi Yeshua," various different Amoraim, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Yochanan, "Shehayotzin chutz la'aretz," they were leaving chutz la'aretz. They got to this place, Paltus, the Zacharit Eretz Yisrael, and they all suddenly remembered they were leaving Eretz Yisrael. Zakru Einehem, Vazalgu Dimoseim, they cried, they wept, their tears came down their face. Karu Vigdeyem, they tore their clothes. Vakaru Etamikram, they read the Pasuk. Virashta, Vyashavta by you, that you have to live in the land, you have to settle the land. Ushmata, and you have to keep the mitzvahs, la'asot, etc., to do them. Amru, and they said, Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael Shkula Keneged Kol HaMitzvot B'Torah. The living in Israel is equivalent to all the mitzvahs in the Torah. Now, that's a very strong statement. On the surface level, it would seem, well, if Eretz Yisrael, living in Eretz Yisrael, is equivalent to all the mitzvahs in the Torah, that's not something that you can give away lightly. On the other hand, it's not the only mitzvah about which Chazal say that this is Shkula, equivalent to all the mitzvahs in the Torah. In fact, if you start adding up all the different mitzvahs that Chazal say in this place or that place or the other place are actually equivalent to all the mitzvahs in the Torah, you come up with a long list. What does that tell us? So one of my Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Berkovitz, said, it tells us we have to be all-rounders. Because if this and this and this and this and this are the most important mitzvahs in the Torah, you obviously can't be just focused on one thing and one thing alone. Which is an interesting point, because you do tend to find that people become very focused on one issue and one issue alone, and that becomes definitive of their entire hashkafic view. And Eretz Yisrael is certainly one of those. There are some people for whom Eretz Yisrael is central and absolutely pivotal to everything else that gets discussed. And there are other people that say no, there are other issues which are perhaps more central, and I think that is legitimate, that there are different perspectives as to what is the most important, but here we see Eretz Yisrael as one of those options. Look at the Ramban. The Ramban wrote on the Sefer HaMitzvahs a number of notes at the end. The Ramban, Maimonides, wrote the Sefer HaMitzvot before he wrote the Mishneh Torah, which is the oral law, codified. He wrote the Sefer HaMitzvahs, which is the written law. He said, first I need to go through the Tariag Mitzvahs, explain to you what the mitzvahs are in the Torah, and then when I go through the Mishneh Torah and I give you the oral law, I will fit all of the oral law onto the various different written mitzvahs. And this is what he does in every chapter, in every book of the Mishneh Torah, which is the Torah Shebaal Peh, codified. He first lists all the mitzvot in the Torah that this relates to. And before he writes a book called Sefer HaMitzvot, he includes all Tariag Mitzvot. He did not include a number of important things, and the question is why not? One of them he did not include was the mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. The Rambam, Maimonides. The question is, why did he exclude that? He clearly understands halachically that it's very important to live in Eretz Yisrael. In other places in Mishneh Torah, he passes the halacha, it's better to live in Eretz Yisrael, in a town which is almost entirely non-Jewish, than to live in Chutz La'aretz, in a town which is almost entirely Jewish. So if you have a choice between Ramallah or Brooklyn, so the Rambam will tell you that Ramallah is the choice that you have to make rather than Brooklyn, assuming that you can live without fear of being killed there, which is a good question, although Brooklyn's not so posh in itself. So that's another question. The Rambam certainly values living in Eretz Yisrael. No question, but he doesn't include it as a mitzvah. And the question is, why not? The Ramban picks up on this and says, no. This should have been one of the Tariag Mitzvot. Number four. Horah. He quotes this Pasuk number one. This is a command. Shehaita mitzvah. Lo yi'ud v'havtacha. It's not simply a promise or a destiny that the Jewish people will get Eretz Israel. It's a mitzvah. V'zohi shachachamim karim oto milchemet mitzvah. And this is what the chachamim called milchemet mitzvah. A milchemet mitzvah is a war in order to settle and secure the borders of the land of Israel. Shenitzaveinu b'kibusha, we are commanded to conquer it. Ube yishivata, okay, and to yishivata, and to live in the land. V'harei nitzaveinu b'kibush b'chol hadorot. He says this mitzvah of kibush is across all generations. Meaning, don't tell me this is something that applies when Mashiach comes. Says the Ramban, absolutely not. This is one of the Tariag Mitzvot, which applies for always. Now, that may be one of the reasons why the Rambam left it out, because he doesn't include mitzvot that only apply at certain times. But that's a separate question. But the Ramban says no, it applies all the time. But I'm Ani, and I want to tell you, he says, Ki ha-mitzvah she'achachamim ablikim ba, this mitzvah that the rabbi stressed so much, that he dirat Eretz Yisrael, this is living in Eretz Yisrael, until the point that they said, Shekol hayotze mimena, anyone who leaves Eretz Yisrael, the darba chutz la'aretz, and chooses to live in chutz la'aretz, yehei be'enecha ka'oved avodah zarah. It's quite a famous statement, Gemara in Ksubos, that anyone who leaves Eretz Yisrael to live in Chutz La'aretz, it's as if they're doing Avodah Zarah. What that means is, beyond the topic of today's share, I'm not really talking about specifically Mitzvah Yishuv of Eretz Yisrael, but you begin to see that the association of Eretz Yisrael with, if you don't live there, it's Avodah Zarah, begins to now take on a new dimension, because we'll see when we have a discussion about Pikuach Nefesh, that yes, you can do all sorts of things which would otherwise be prohibited in order to avoid danger to life, but there are some that you can't. And one of them is Avodah Zarah. So we'll see whether Eretz Yisrael falls in that category of things that even Pikuach Nefesh does not justify breaking. In Cain, he mitzvah Aseh Ledoireh says, therefore, says the Ramban, it is a positive mitzvah for all generations. Mitchayev kol yachid mimen. And every individual, it's not just a communal mitzvah, every individual has a personal chiyuv to do this. Afilu bizman galut, even in the exile times, like today, ki yadua b'talmud b'komotah, as we've seen the Talmud in many places. And this Ramban is a classic source for the mitzvah, and indeed the chiyuv of every individual in the world, every Jewish individual, to do what they can to live in Eretz Yisrael. Of course, there are heterim, there are different halakhic categories of people who do not have to do this. So people who need shiduchim, people who need paranasa, people who are in a situation of hunger, etc. I'm not getting into all that now. But the Ramban clearly rules that it is a mitzvah and a chiyuv d'oraisa to live in Eretz Yisrael, to conquer it at all times. Now, again, this is not the only position. Rav Moshe Feinstein held that there was a mitzvah kiyumit to live in Eretz Yisrael, meaning that if you live in Eretz Yisrael, that is a mitzvah. But it is not a mitzvah chiyumit, it's not something which is an obligation. There are mitzvahs like that. For example, the mitzvah to have children is on men is a mitzvah chiyumit. They have an obligation to have children. On women is a mitzvah kiyumit, meaning they don't have an obligation to have children until they get married, and then they do. At least on a doraita level, women have a mitzvah to have children. It's not like they have children, it's a zero. It's not true. It's a mitzvah doraita. It's just not a chiyuv doraita. There are a number of mitzvahs like arba kanfos, like tzitzis. There is no chiyuv to get yourself a four-cornered garment in order to put mitzvahs, to put tzitzit on it. But once you have a four-cornered garment, then you have to then do what you need to do, etc. So the Ramban, however, says it is a mitzvah chiyuvit, not just kiyumit, and one has to do this at all times. Most of the people who object to giving away Eretz Yisrael under any circumstances are obviously starting from the position of the Ramban. Because if you're not starting from the Ramban, it's hard to make that argument the same way. There are other issues. Look at number five. When the Tatim Hashem Elokecha Lefanecha, God will give our enemies before us, Vehikisam, Hachirem, Vahachrem, Tachrim, Otam, you will destroy the enemies, the seven nations, whatever. Lo Tichrot Lahem Brit, don't do any deals with them. Velo Tachanem, and do not give them Chen. What does that mean? Gemara in Avodah Zarah, number six, Amar Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, Da'am Akra, Lo Tachanem, do not give them Chen. Lo Titen Lahem Chanaya Bakarka. Chanaya, chen as in lo tachanem, is don't give them a chanaya. Chanaya meaning a fixed connection with the land, a place where they can actually call their own. Meaning, of course, non-Jewish people have always been welcome to live in Eretz Yisrael. There is a Geret Toshav concept where a non-Jew can live in Eretz Yisrael. They don't have to be Jewish, they just have to be monotheistic. But they cannot have a chanaya batarka, meaning they cannot establish a state within a state, if you like, or their own permanent status in the land in their own independent way. So that is an issue. Now, on the surface, we'll see that Lo Tachanem seems to be a very big problem. How on earth can you sell land to non-Jewish people and give them a state within a state if that is a prohibition in the Torah? However, we'll see that it's not so straightforward, because we also hit that problem slightly in Shemitah as well. Where we do actually, as far as the Heter Mechira is concerned, sell land to non-Jews in order to for the Heter Mechira to work. And of course we're going to have... What's that? Okay, so there are differences, of course. There are differences. A, it's temporary. B, it is done in order to strengthen the Yishuv rather than weaken the Yishuv of Eretz Yisrael. But nevertheless, Lo Tachanem seems to be something which can be negotiated around or worked around in some way. And we'll see Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal is going to say in a letter to Rav Avram Shapiro that when it comes to giving land away for peace, Lo Tachanem is a major issue. But when it comes to the Heter Mechira, all of a sudden it's all fine. And we'll see, of course, it's not exactly the same, but that is an argument which is used. Let us go on a little bit. There is, of course, Pikuach Nefesh, number 7. She'elach adav she'omi b'bnei Pikuach Nefesh, says the Gemara, nothing stands in the face of Pikuach Nefesh, chutz me'avodah zarah gilui arayis l'shifras damim. Living in Eretz Yisrael is not included in that list that stands in the face of Pikuach Nefesh. On the other hand, there's going to be lots of on the one hand, on the other hand, today's shir. On the other hand, if leading Eretz Yisrael is like Avodah Zarah, and if Eretz Yisrael, living in Eretz Yisrael is the most important mitzvah in the Torah, as we've seen, maybe it is, maybe this is included in this list in some way, we'll see that later. The Minchas Chinuch raises a fascinating question and says, look, it can't be that simple. There is a mitzvah to go to war in the Torah against the seven nations and conquer Eretz Yisrael. Yeshua had that mitzvah. Oh, so what about the Pikuach Nefesh? Meaning, if somebody says to a person, if you don't eat pork, we'll kill you, then of course, there is a chiyuv to eat the pork and not to be killed. Unless it's a time of Shmad, which we'll talk about, we'll bring that in afterwards. But if a person says, you know, you have to fight in the Israeli army to capture Eretz Israel in your times of Yeshua, why couldn't a person turn around and say, oh, well, you know, it's dangerous, you know. Pikuach Nefesh. Pikuach Nefesh pushes aside all mitzvahs. Certainly, this is not one of the big three. I don't have to fight for Eretz Yisrael. Says the Minchas Chinuch, it can't be that. That doesn't make any sense. Look at number 8. So he quotes the Chinuch and he says, V'noig mitzvah zo, this is the mitzvah of Kibush Haaretz of the seven nations, V'chol Ish Yisraeli, Heim Anashim, both men, V'nashim and women, K'mavuah B'shat, as it says in the Shas, the Milchomet mitzvah, when it comes to a Milchomet mitzvah, Afilu Kala Michupata, we even take the kalah from under the chuppah and push it into the war effort. Exactly what she needs to do is a good question. It may be that she doesn't need to jump in a tank and run to the front. It may be that she needs to support the war effort in other ways. But in principle, she has to fight, whatever fighting means. The kasav, Rava Machava, the over alzer, ubal yadai, says the chinuch says a person is over on this if they get opportunity to do it. The yachal lahorga, and they are able to kill the second of seven nations, midli sheyistakein, without being endangered. Because pikuach nefesh. But Tzarechini says, this is very difficult. The kol mitzvahs nidach nifnei ha-sakana. Of course, all mitzvahs are pushed away because of sakana. Nikol nachon, nevertheless, mitzvah zon, this particular mitzvah, to conquer Eretz Yisrael. The ha-Torah tzivsa, lilchomim ahem, the Torah has commanded us to fight. You can't conquer without fighting. The yadua, and it's well known, the ha-Torah loitis moch dinah, Alanais, we don't have to keep the Torah expecting miracles. K'mubaba Ramban, as he quotes the Ramban. U'b'derech ha'olam ne'ragi mishnei ha'tzadim. And of course, the derech ha'olam, the way the wars work, and the people are killed on both sides, you can't avoid casualties. Ba'it milchama, when you fight a war. In Cain, chazinu, we see therefore, the ha'Torah gazra alil chanimayim. The Torah has commanded us to fight. Af dehu sakana, even though that is dangerous. Ve'in Cain, d'chuyah sakana, b'mokamza. Therefore, you have to say, says the Minchas Chinuch, that Pikuach Nefesh cannot be used as an argument to argue against fighting for Eretz Yisrael. Because the whole nature of a mitzvah to fight involves Pikuach Nefesh. It has to be an exception. And therefore, we'll see this Minchas Chinuch becomes a very important feature as to whether you bring in Pikuach Nefesh or not when it comes to Eretz Yisrael. And those people who are more in favor of land for peace do not follow this Minchas Chinuch, and those who are more against the idea of land for peace say, look, don't bring Pikuach Nefesh. It's not relevant here. It's very relevant for Hilchos Kashrus. It's not relevant when the Torah tells me to fight a war. It's obviously going to be dangerous.
What period was the Minchas Chinuch
really? He lived in the 19th century. His name was Babad. He was a chassid, and he lived up in Europe in the 19th century. Okay, the Sefer Chinuch was written in the 12th century. 13th century, but we don't know exactly by him. Now, anyway, so these are the main sources that we have to deal with. The issue of Yeshiva Ta'aretz, of Kibush Ha'aretz, the issue of Lo Tachaneim, of not giving the Machanaya Bakarka, and the issue of Pikuach Nefesh. Let's go and have a look at a few other issues, and then we'll see some modern voices on this topic for the second half of the show. One issue which we need to look at is, who decides in giving away land for peace? Which is a good question. Who should make that decision? First of all, is it the entire Jewish community in the world? Does everybody get a vote on that? The Jews of South America and the Jews of Europe? Or is it only people living in Eretz Israel? There are a lot of sources you can bring, which I haven't gone into them all, that for these kind of issues, Klal Yisrael is defined by the Jews living in Eretz Israel. For example, there is a mitzvah on the Sanhedrin. If the majority of Jews follow a psak of the Sanhedrin, which is incorrect, then the Sanhedrin has to bring a certain korban on behalf of the Jews. Okay, para elam davar. The Jews for this purpose are calculated as the Jews living in Eretz Israel. Meaning, if a majority of Jews living in Eretz Israel did this, then that the mitzvah applies. It's irrelevant what happens outside Eretz Yisrael. So it may well be that Eretz Yisrael is the defining feature halachically, and we don't just go around the whole world, but that's already a decision. Also, who do we ask? What about whose advice do we take on this issue? This is a very difficult one. A lot of the people, Rav Hirsch Schechter has an article about this, and it seems posh that we compare this to a medical situation. If someone, God forbid, has a serious medical problem, and they need to know whether to take medical intervention, which might be quite dramatic, may even be life-threatening, but it may be life-saving. How does a person make that decision? And the answer has to be that they go to the doctors. They can't just pull something out of a hat and toss a coin and say yes or no. They have to seek medical advice. And on the basis of the medical advice, they'll proceed or not proceed. The problem that you have is when you have conflicting medical advice. How many opinions do you take? 4 doctors against 3 doctors, 8 doctors against 6 doctors. How does that work? So too, when it comes to land for peace, who do we believe when they tell us that this is the right thing, this will save life or this will cost life? Because everybody has an opinion on this. Do we believe the politicians? Well, that's a chiddush, to believe politicians on anything, okay? Do we believe the military people? Because surely the military people have no political leanings either way. Well, that's also naive, because in this country, it's exactly the military people that become tomorrow's politicians. So how do we know who to trust on these issues? That is a very, very difficult thing to decide. When it comes to the medical analogy, we know that once we have made a decision, look at number 14, the Rambam says, Kashem, Sharofe Chotech Yado, or Aglo, Shelzeh. Just like the doctor sometimes has to say, there has to be an amputation. Kidesh Yichia Kulo. Oh, sorry, I missed the page. I beg your pardon. We'll go back to that page in a minute. I'll go back to page 2 in a second. Kach Beit Din Morim Bizman Min Azmanim La'avor Aktas Mitzvahs. Sometimes the Beit Din has to decide to break certain mitzvahs, the Fisha, according to on a temporary basis, Kadesh is Kaimu Kula. Just like you have to sometimes amputate the limb to save the whole body, sometimes you have to amputate the mitzvah, says the Rambam, to save the whole system. And therefore, we have to take a long-term, not a short-term approach to this. Page 2, which actually is very important, which I'm going to go back to, I apologize for skipping it. Is there any historical precedent or anything in the Tanakh that we can look at in terms of giving land away to make peace with our neighbors in Eretz Israel? And there are a few, but each of them go in different directions, and that's the problem. First of all, you have the well-known Rashbam on the Akedah, where the Rashbam, let's look at a few lines from this Rashbam. He says, "Vayhi achar dvarim ha'ele." So kol makom shenema achar dvarim ha'ele, whenever you see in the Torah, it says, after these things, he says, "Mechubar ala parsha shenemala." It's linked with the parsha that came before. And he brings various different proofs throughout the Torah, throughout Tanakh, that when it says one story, and then it says, after these things, this happened, it means that there's a link being brought. So if you skip down a few lines, he brings the example of Mordechai and Esther, and Big Son and Teresh, etc. I want to pick it up 4 lines down in the middle of the line. Akkan, here too. Acha hadvarim, shekarat Avram brit, that Avram entered into a treaty. La Avimelech, with Avimelech, okay? Loi, with him. Ula Ninoi, and his children. Ula Nechtoi, and his grandchildren, shall Avram. V'natn loi sheva kevasoi tatsoi. And he gave them the 7 sheep. This Be'er Sheva, this Brit that they made in Be'er Sheva, that they would not go to war against each other. V'chara aposhel HaKadosh Baruch Hu alzais. And God was very angry, says the Rashbam on this, you see from the text. Shehari Eretz Plishtim b'chlal gvul Yisrael. Because Eretz Plishtim is included in Eretz Yisrael. It's not for Avram to do a deal with the Plishtim that he's not going to need that land. V'HaKadosh Baruch Hu tziva aleihem. God commanded us ultimately to take that. The Gambi Yeshua Matilim Ala Arei Hamesha Sarin Plishtim Goral. Yeshua includes that in the lottery in the Goral for Eretz Israel. So look at what the Rashbam says. Amazing words. Ulechein, therefore we see him afterwards, Vahelokim Nisa Et Abraham. That God tested, God went against Abraham. We'll see he translates the word Nisa as contrariel in French, to go to oppose someone. Okay. Kinatroi Vitziro. He argued with him and he afflicted him. Kolomer to say, Nidgaeta b'ben shenatatid. Have you become proud all of a sudden of this son that I gave you, Yitzchak? Lichrot brit, so you're now making deals beinechem between them, ubein beinechem, between your children and his children. Meaning you're now so confident that you have children, you can start doing deals between your grandchildren and the neighbor's grandchildren. Va'ata lech ve'elei ula'oila. Go bring your child now as a sacrifice, And we'll see what becomes of your deals with the local non-Jewish nations. You're confident you're going to have a son? Not so straightforward. You've got no business making deals with anybody, and you've got no business giving Eretz Israel. Says the Rashbam, therefore the Akedah was a direct result of Avram's inappropriate deal with the Plishtim, and he gives other examples. As he finds it in Chazal, it's not just him. He quotes, because of the seven sheep that Avram gave away, so seven things happened. We lost seven temples, and we lost seven great people in Eretz Israel, etc., etc. So the Rashbam clearly has a very strong position against doing deals with the local Plishtim. But is this halachic? And do we follow this Rashbam? Most of the other Meforshim do not take this view of the Meforshim, of the Pesukim. They don't connect the two in the same way. So maybe the Rashbam is a very anti-land for peace approach, but is that the only approach that there is?
Rashbam was the grandson
of Rashi, correct. The grandson of Rashi, the elder brother of Vayinatam. So there is the Rashbam. There's also Shlomo HaMelech. He gave 20 cities to Hiram, the king of Lebanon, as a gift to him. Look in number 10, it says, Hiram Melech Tzor, Nisa'et Shlomo, Ba'atei Arazim. He sent him lots of material for the Beit HaMikdash, Uba'atei Baroshim, Uba'zahav, Lechol Chemzoi, Az Yiten HaMelech Shlomo LeChiram Esrim Ir Be'eret HaGalil. Shlomo gives him 20 cities in the Galil. Says the Radak in number 11, Shlomo gam keinatan lechiram arim b'galil, v'zeha lechazek abrit b'neihem, in order to secure the peace deal between them, he gave away towns in Eretz Israel. Now, this seems like, oh, so you can give away towns in Eretz Israel in order to secure a peace deal. But what does this mean? Does this mean he gave the towns away? Or, as Rav Midan in the Gush says, that it just means he gave him tax revenues for the towns. It doesn't mean he physically had sovereignty over the towns. It could mean a number of different things. Also, in Divrei Hayamim, it actually says the opposite, that Hiram gave Shlomo towns rather than Shlomo gave Hiram towns, and therefore it's not so posh. Chizkiyahu. Look in number 12. Tan Rabbanan. Shisha Dvarim Asa Chizkiyahu HaMelech. Six things, say Chazal, Chizkiyahu did. Hashloisha Hodulah Vashloisha Hodulah. Three of them the rabbis agreed, and three of them the rabbis said no. So which one of the ones that they said no? Kitzeit Delasei Shel Heichel. He cut off the doors of the Heichel. Veshigran LeMelech Ashurin. He sent them to the king of Assyria. Vala Hodulah. They said, you shouldn't have done that. You're chopping up the Beit HaMikdash. Why did he send it to the king of Assyria? To appease him, to keep him away, to keep him happy. He's sending him bits of the Beit HaMikdash. Says Rashi, Shehayel Liv Toyach, he should have had bitachon. Shehakadosh Baruch Hu said the following, Sheama veganoisi el ha'ir hazot. Hashem says to Chizkiyahu, I will protect the city. I will save it. Look at the psukim before this. That God turns around and says, you don't have to worry about Jerusalem falling to Assyria. It won't. I'll protect it. Chizkiyahu's got nothing to worry about. Why is he chopping up bits of the Beit HaMikdash and worrying about losing the battle with Hiram, with the king of Aram? So, is this a source that we're not allowed to do things? We should have more bitachon. If Hashem has promised us the land, then we'll have the land. Or, could you turn around and say, well, this is if you have a nevuah, then don't go against it. He had a nevuah. We don't have a nevuah. So, if we don't have a nevuah, how are we going against a nevuah in order to have bitachon? It's not so straightforward. Similarly, Rabbi Yochanan had a deal with the Romans. Have a look at number 13. At the end of the second Beit HaMikdash, Vespasian comes to Rabbi Yochanan and says the following. Ask me something and I will give it to you. Meaning, I give you one request, Rabbi Yochanan. The whole story in the Gemara then gives you Rabbi Yochanan was smuggled out from the old city during the siege. He got to see Vespasian. He gets this 1 minute with Vespasian and he says to him, okay, so ask. Whatever you want, you can ask now. Amalekah, he said to him, Ten li Yavne, v'chachameha, very famous this, allow me to regroup in Yavne from Yerushalayim. Okay? V'shulshil to the Rabbi Gamliel and save the line of the Nasi of Rabbi Gamliel. V'asvata, the Messiah le'el Rabbi Tzadik, and find me a doctor for Rabbi Tzadik, which is a separate issue. Fine. And he agreed to all those three things. So look at this. Karya le Rabbi Yosef, the Itema Rabbi Akiva, that 100 years later, less, 50 years later, Rabbi Akiva says about this, Meshiv Chachamim Achor, that the rabbi's advice can go backwards, Vedatam Yisakel, and their view can be idiotic. Sachil. Iboy le Meimale, what should he have said to Vespasian? L'shavkinu hadazimna, leave it alone. Leave Yerushalayim. If you had an opportunity to ask, why didn't you ask for Yerushalayim? Why are you doing deals with Vespasian? Oh, but who savav? The Ramara answers, Rabbi Yochanan felt
Dilma kula hai lo yavit. You can't ask for the impossible. The hatsala prutsa nami lo yavit. And they wouldn't get anything. If they asked for too much, they get nothing at all. So he did a deal. Now, Rabbi Akiva obviously disagrees with this approach. Rabbi Akiva said, no, if you can fight, fight. If you can ask for more, ask for more. And Rabbi Yochanan said, no, that's not how it works. Sometimes you have to recognize that other people are more powerful than you. Again, how does that affect us today in terms of land for peace? So it can go either way. If you can turn around and say, look, Rabbi Akiva turned around to Rabbi Yochanan and said, you can't do deals with the superpowers thinking they're going to help you. They're not going to help you. You have to get the best you possibly can. Rabbi Yochanan says, you're not living in the real world. In the real world, there's politics. In politics, we have to recognize who we are. Now, is that the same as today? Maybe not. Maybe they were in a desperate situation. In desperate situations, call for desperate measures. Are we in a desperate situation today? So again, that depends on who you are. Some people say yes. Some people say ridiculous. Absolutely not. And that's going to affect how you take these different views. Anyway, let's have a look at some modern voices on this issue in the 20 minutes you have. First of all, there are those who wish to be more messianic about the whole situation. The Gemara says, for example, number 15, Umar olama ge'ula v'shivit. Why is ge'ula the seventh bracha in the Shemona Esrei? Amar Rava. Rava says, Mitoy she'atidin li'ga'el b'shivit, because one day we will be redeemed in the seventh year, in the Shemitah year. Lefikach kavu b'shivit. Therefore, they put the bracha of ge'ula as the seventh bracha. Okay? The Amar Mara says, the Gemara says, is that right? Will we have Mashiach in the Shemitah year? Is that correct? The Hamamah don't we see Bashishit Kolos in the sixth year there'll be rumblings, and in the Shviit Milchamot in the seventh year when Mashiach is coming in the Shemitah year there'll be war, and are you telling me that this is the redemption? It says there's going to be war. Says the Gemara, no, Milchama Nami Atchalta de Geulahu. Milchama is also part of the Geulah. Meaning, this is a much bigger question, but do you look at the matzav that we have in Eretz Israel right now and say, how can you possibly have messianic pretensions? It's ridiculous. We're at war with everybody. We have been for 70 years. That's not Geula. And others will turn around and say, why not? Why not? Why are you defining Geula in some very specific way to say that this is not Geula? Maybe this is exactly what Geula is. Maybe Milchama is at Chalta de Geula. And again, I can't go into all of this now. There's lots of material on this. I'm sure you know it very well. But this fundamentally is a major discussion. When the Haredi world in this country says this is not Geula, and the religious science world say this is at least the beginning of Geula, they're defining Geula in different ways. It's not that they're disagreeing about the situation we're in. They're defining Geula in different ways. Go back to the first Beit HaMikdash. When we had a Beit HaMikdash and we had a country, was that a situation of peace? No. Other than 40 years of Shlomo HaMelech, the whole thing was fighting. We had non-religious leaders leading Eretz Israel to war against our neighbors. That was Geula. So if that's Geula, is this Geula? Maybe yes, maybe no. Even Rabbi Akiva was difficult to pin down this. Well, he clearly had an opinion, but other people didn't agree. Look at number 17. Tanu Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Akiva, okay? Rebbe, Akiva, my master, Hayadoresh, would say, Dorach Kochav mi Yaakov, that a star would come out from Yaakov. What does this mean? Not a Kochav, but Dorach Kozba. Bar Kochba was called Bar Koziba, but Bar Kochba is the Mashiach. Rebbe Akiva, Kad Havachame, Bar Koziba, when he would see Bar Koziba, Havaama, he would say, Dein hu Malke Mashiach. This is the Mashiach. Amalei Rabbi Yochanan ben Turta, Rabbi Yochanan ben Turta would say to him, Akiva, are you serious? Yale asavim belechayecha, the grass will be growing on your cheeks. The adain ben David loba, before Mashiach comes. Maybe you'll be long dead and buried before Mashiach comes. This is not the king. This is not Mashiach. You're wrong. And the Gemara ends on that section. It says, Abba Rabbi Yochanan, kol Adrianus keitha horig bebeitar shmonim elef ribut. And the ultimate result of Rabbi Akiva's messianic dreams were millions of casualties, millions of deaths. Again, what is the Gemara telling us? To be confident about Mashiach, to be careful about Mashiach. How does that work? On the other hand, there are clear signs. Look at number 16, Amar Rabbi Abba, Ein lecha keitz migulamizeh. There's no clearer indication of the times of Mashiach than the following. Shinemar says, "Va'atem Hari Yisrael." Rashi then explains what does this mean. "Vugulem ezer shetiten Eretz Yisrael piriyah ba'ain yafa, az yikra yikarev akets." Then the case will be near when Eretz Yisrael starts to flower, to blossom. The Eilecha case in Gulam Yosef. You've got no greater indication of Eretz Yisrael blossoming. Hence Rabbi Gold says, still, I'm sure, certainly used to say, if you want to speak to God, you go to the Kotel. But if you want to see God, you go to the Shuk. Go to the Shuk. Look at the fruit. Look at the vegetables. Look at the market. Look at Eretz Yisrael responding in an unmistakable way. So what are you going to say to that? Difficult to know. Anyway, this is all by way of background. What do the modern voices say about Land for Peace? So I've brought you 6 or 7 perspectives on this, some of which you will know, and some of which may be new to you. First of all, Rav Avadia Yosef said very clearly in 1980, and then again in 1989, the following. Looking in number 18 for a second. Ulam, Im Roshai, okay, Im Roshai, Umfakte Hatzava, if the leaders of the army, okay, Yachad Im Chevri HaMemshala, together with the government, Yikvu, they decide sheyesh pikuach nefesh b'davar, that there is again pikuach nefesh in the issue. Sheim lo yuchzru shtachim me'eretz Yisrael kayemet sakana milchama, that if we don't give away land, there'll be a war miyadit, an immediate danger of war mitzad hashcheinim haravim. Okay, im yuchzru, but if we hand back land lahem hashtachim, okay, turchak me'aleinu sakanat milchama, that the war danger will go away. The Yeshukim Shalom Bar Kayama, and there's a hope for a real peace. Nira says, it seems to me, Shalakol Hadayot, according to every opinion, Mutal Hazir Shtachim Eretz Yisrael, Lama'an Hasagat Matarazo. That it is permitted to give away land in Israel to achieve its aim, She'ein Lechadavar Ha'omed Bifnei Pikuach Nefesh. Because nothing is more important than Pikuach Nefesh, if indeed the military are able to establish that this will indeed be a valid military move. He said, as far as the halakha is concerned, absolutely it is mutar to give land away in Eretz Israel. He says this again in 1989 in an article in Tchumim, the same idea. He says, of course, we have to think very carefully about this and we have to take a lot of advice, but he says, in principle, it is mutar. However, if you look on the top of page 4, in 2003, he wrote very clearly, after Oslo, after the Intifada, or during the second Intifada, he says in number 20, Rav Avadia, "Beretzoni lahav nir emdati be'inyan yesha." I want to clarify my position on Yehuda Shomron va'Aza. He says, "Lo pam izbarti nikvar ki psak halacha asher natati bizmano shtachim tmurat shalom." But when I gave a psak on land for peace, eno tokef klal leregla matzav anochasi, that has no application to the current situation, said Rav Avadia. I was talking about a real peace. In fact, that's what he said. I'm talking about a peace which is Bar Kayama. In which Yerushalayim and its environments can be in peace. What do we have now? In Yanora, Einenu Rods. We see with our own eyes. Ki Adarav, on the contrary, Mesirat Shtachim Me'arteinu Akadosha, Goremid Etakanan Tavashot. Giving land away creates more danger to life. Now, is that a halachic statement or a political statement? And as Rav Avadia was clearly both a politician and a poset. Lo l'shalom kezeh yichalnu. Okay, v'lo l'narazeh talanu. This is not the peace that we were wanting or talking about. L'fikach heskem ozlo batel u'mubuta. That's it. Not interesting. We'll talk about that in a minute. We'll bring that down in a minute. So, it may be a halacha that Esav hates Yaakov. Is it a halacha that Yishmael hates Yaakov? And that's an interesting question. Because Yishmael and Esav are dealt with differently by the poskim, and if you want to get into hashkafic understandings, Yishmael is the classic ultimate Baal Tshuva. Esav is never the Baal Tshuva. Yishmael is the Baal Tshuva. So is Hagar. So what does that mean, and how does that work? That's a very interesting question. You know, Rav Riskin tells a story when Rav Tzvi Yehuda, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was asking. We'll see Rav Tzvi Yehuda in a few minutes. When Rav Tzvi Yehuda was asking Rav Riskin to bring the town of Efrat into the Gush Emunim movement in the 1970s, which Rav Riskin refused to do. So Rav Riskin asked Rav Tzvi Yehuda, what's with all the Arabs? There are millions of Arabs living in the Yehuda Vashomron. How are we going to deal with that? What's about the demographic time bomb? How's this going to work, etc.? So Rav Tzvi Yehuda turned to Rav Riskin. This is how he told me. He grasped his hands and he said to him, don't worry. Heim yityahadu. Heim yityahadu. They'll become Jewish. Heim yityahadu. In other words, they will convert. The Arabs, don't worry about the Arabs. The Arabs will become Jews eventually. Meaning, Esav soneh et Yaakov, Maybe that's the case. The halacha here, that's the halacha. But Yishmael, who knows? Rav Tzvi Yehuda wasn't worried ultimately about Yishmael, because he said ultimately, because he's living in a messianic process. We'll see eventually how that works. So Rav Avadi Yosef clearly said, land for peace in principle, yes, halachically acceptable, but what we have now, he was saying 15 years ago, is not what I had in mind in the 1980s. Okay. Rav Moshe Tzuriel, who is a well-known figure in the religious Zionist community, raises a few important issues. I'm just going to pick a couple of things out from this. He talks about land for peace, he talks about sakanat nefashot. But then he says, have a look in the second paragraph, about four lines up from the bottom. He's a big expert on Rav Kook's writings, and he's a Talmud of Rav Tzuriel. Originally is from America, and he came to Eretz Yisrael, and he learned under Rav Tzvi Yehuda. He says, I've said many times before, Shetvayt ha-goyim b'zeh, ki begedet tviyat ha-goyim la'avor al-dat. Says, as far as I'm concerned, giving land for peace, and he's gone back in the previous paragraph and explained why it's also for this and it's also for that. He says, as far as I'm concerned, it's called going against the basic religion of Judaism. It's like becoming a convert. It's like a avodah zarah. Umimele yeherag v'al yavor. Therefore, it has the status of yeherag v'al yavor. Afilu al arkasa de masama, which is the example the Gemara gives, that even on a minhag, even on the shoe strap of a shoe, if there's a Jewish minhag to do something a certain way, in a time of shmat, if the non-Jews want us to stop doing that in order to defeat publicly Judaism, you're not allowed to go even against the tiniest little thing, even though it's not one of the big three. So he says, this is a time of shmat, and you cannot give away Eretz Israel for anything. Okay? Ken Kosov Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook wrote this, and we'll see his writings in a minute, on this particular issue. And then he says there's an Issa Doraisa for the Rambam as well, etc. And therefore not one piece of Eretz Yisrael may be given away because of various different reasons. Let's look at Rav Tzvi Yehuda now. Number 22. We have absolutely no right to relinquish control over any piece of Eretz Yisrael. We cannot do this because we are not the only owners of the land. We are the emissary of millions of Jews. Not only the Jews of today, but the Jews who will come after us as well. A short while ago, an important Zionist activist told me that an old Russian woman approached him in Vienna and told him, hold on to all parts of Eretz Israel for us. Do not relinquish a meter. Soon we will be coming. This is before the Russians came. Then it was just a dream that the Russians would come. Now it's a dream come true, or not a dream come true, depending on how you look at it. But it's certainly a dream come true in terms of getting the Russians out of Russia. That's for sure. There isn't a man who is permitted to make territorial concessions on this land. Are these kilometers ours? Is someone the owner of them? Which is also what Rav Tzuriel says, and we'll see Rav Malamed says in a minute. These kilometers belong to the millions of Jews in Russia and America and throughout the world, no less than they belong to us. We are here as the representatives of the nation of Israel. We are not its owners without them. It's interesting, bringing the Jews of Chutz La'aretz in, saying, what right do we have to compromise the Jews of America's claim to Eretz Yisrael by giving it to someone else? How can a person not feel ashamed by the thought of making do with a truncated state? No one has the right to relinquish lands which belong to the millions of Jews of all generations. This is a disgrace, a sorrowful shame, a violation of Torah, etc., etc. And he brings in Lo Tzachanim. Very powerful stuff. Says number 23, the state of Israel is holy. There must be no retreat from a single kilometer of the land of Israel, God forbid. But on the contrary, we will conquer and liberate more and more, as much in a spiritual as a physical sense. This is classic Rav Kook. There is no room for compromise on this issue at all. Rav Kook is part of a messianic process. There is no question about that. He almost had the status himself of a Navi when he stood up in 1967, before the Six-Day War, on Yom Ha'atzmaut, and said that even though we don't have Shechem and Hebron and Yerushalayim, we will have them, and we'll have them soon. And then 6 weeks later we have them. People looked at Rav Tzvi Yehuda almost as a Navi in our times, and his position on land for peace was absolutely clear. Go over, please, to page number 5. Let me show you what we've got there. Rav Malamed brings 7 different reasons why it is prohibited to give away a single, look in the top line, Asur Latet Shetach Mishitchei Eretz Yisrael Nochrim, Afilu Netinat Shel Regev Adama Achad. Even one clod of earth, one piece of ground is Asur, Vakama Yisurim Kuchim Bakach. And there are many Yisurim, you can look in your own time, I've listed them here. This is from the Pnini Halacha, he talks about Mitzvah Yishav Haaretz, Sakanat Nefashot. He says it's going to cause more sakana, not less sakana, but again, that is not so much a halachic assessment as a political or military one. And then he gives other reasons as well. Lois Tachanim is another one, Gezelat Bait HaYachid, of stealing people's homes by evicting them from their own homes, etc. And he brings Chilul Hashem. In number 26, he says something interesting. He says, "V'ilu kol ha-mumchim ha-tzva'im, if all of the army experts, hayu kamim va'omrim kayom, would stand up and say together, she'im nisuk achein nasig shalom amati, that if we gave away land, maybe we'll reach a complete peace. Yitachein v'hayinu amrim, it could be that we would say, she'nishtanu hazmanim, that the times have changed, u'kayom eitzakal nefoshet v'sika, and that there wouldn't be a danger." In other words, he leaves the door open. He says, look, at the end of the day, a lot of his arguments are based on the reality, as he understands it, that there is no real peace. There is no real partner. There is nothing to talk about. But he says, if it could be that the military experts of the land would stand up and say that there really is a peace, maybe we'd have something to talk about. But then he brings, at the bottom, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, interesting, Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who said many things on this in the past, and I brought his opinion as well. Rabbi Schneerson said many things on the issue of land for peace. He was very, very vocally against the idea of giving land away for peace. You can read the comments in your own time there, his in English here from 27 through to 31. He talks about secret talks in the 1960s that with the Arabs, and that they're never going to go anywhere, and that they're imperiling Eretz Israel, and it's all basically smoke and mirrors. He wrote a letter to one of the ministers, Moshe Katsav. We'll talk any more about that right now. In number 31, where he says, "I heard a bizarre and shocking rumor that the Israeli government is discussing a plan to give away portions of land Eretz Israel." And he says, "Go and ask the Arabs." You speak Arabic, he says to him. "Go and ask the Arabs what they're saying about these plans, and then you'll know whether they're real or not real, etc." So Rav Schneerson was clearly against. Rav Shach, and we need to look at Rav Shach properly here in number 32, had some interesting things to say. Rav Shach, of course, was undisputably the leader of the Haredi population in Eretz Israel through the 1970s, 80s, 90s. Look at what he says. "Ulam, the Indian mashakas of Pilpul Hilchati, Vadava Hachazarat Shtachim Eretz Israel." I'm sorry, the writing's a bit small in number 32. When it comes to this issue, now they're under Israeli control. We can debate pikuach nefesh back and forth. Says, "I'm not sure which way pikuach nefesh goes on this issue," he says. "There are many different army opinions that say different things. Maybe it could be that we'll get peace through," this is in the 70s, "through giving away land. Maybe we'll get less murder rather than more." He says you can argue in different ways, and the experts say different things. And by the way, that's still the case. You should just know. Don't think for one minute that the military experts in this country say that giving land for peace is a bad thing. There are many military people in this country that still argue for unilateral withdrawal after everything. From Gaza, from just like we did from Gaza, from Erez and Yehuda v'Shomron. And at the end of the day, I'm not a military expert. I don't know why they say that, and I don't have the background that they have, but they do say that. And therefore, do I discount their view completely? Do I ignore them? That's a good question. Says Rav Shach, it's not so posh. Let us continue what he says. "Ludati, Eidah Zed Tzel Shel Safek." I'm on the fifth line down. There's not a shadow of a doubt. "Kush Yishro Shalom Yitmai Tashvichatam." If we do get peace, of course there'll be less bloodshed. This is an important point. So you can't just look at our situation in Eretz Israel. You have to look at the whole world. It's not just about us. When there's no peace in the Middle East, that causes unrest in the whole world. And he does an analysis of the Cold War and how different countries go to different sides. And look down at the bottom of five lines up from the bottom. Why do we people say it's also to give way at all? Because Yerusha, which we have from our fathers. Does it depend on us? Is it in our hands? He says, without the help of America, even less than a month, we couldn't survive a month without America, he says. People say higher and higher. These are people who are poor but arrogant, who are saying we can do it on our own. Which is a classic Haredi approach on this issue, which is that we're living in a dream world if we think
that we can do it alone. This is not the reality. Go back to Rabbi Yochanan and think about how he dealt with Vespasian. Let me show you the last two sources, and then we'll finish in a minute or two. Lord Jacobovitz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who I remember well speaking about these things in the 90s, became quite unpopular in some circles. I remember, he says, number 33, no rabbinical authority disputes that our claim to a divine mandate extends over the entire Holy Land within its historic borders, and that halakhically we have no right to surrender this claim. But what is questionable is whether we must or indeed may assert it at the risk of thousands of lives, if not the life of the state itself. Any religious law is set aside, even passing on Kippur, if it involves a danger to life. Again, pikuach nefesh. Rabbis in giving such rulings in respect of individuals are required to rely on expert opinions to discern what constitutes dangers. Similarly, it would seem we are halakhically compelled to leave the judgment on what provides the ultimate security for Jewish life in Israel to military and political experts, not rabbis. Included as a major factor in this difficult judgment must also be the overriding concern to preserve the Jewish character of Israel, which may clearly depend on the proportion of Jews in the state. Rav Jacobovitz is talking about demographics. Remember, Rav Tzvi Yehuda was not interested in demographics. Why? Heilit Yadu. Why is he worried about 1.5 million Arabs? They'll all be Jewish soon anyway. We're in Yemos HaMashiach. Or we're on the way, says Rav Jacobovitz. Not Pashut. What's going to be with the life of the state? We're going to have votes for the Arabs. We're going to have no votes for the Arabs. For in the suspension of religious laws for life-saving purposes, a threat to the Jewish spiritual life, to physical life, is considered alike. And therefore, he says, the present ceding of some territory, if necessary and consistent with security requirements, may conceivably be justified as a ringing act of faith to promote regional and international peace, and as a goodwill gesture of immense value to establish friendly relations with the neighboring peoples, ideals of human fellowship to which Judaism is passionately dedicated. People didn't like it when he said that. Now, whether he'd say that in 2015 is a whole other question, because he's not alive anymore, and you can't put words into the mouths of people who are not alive. He does say in the next paragraph, in an altogether unique category, is Jerusalem. He says, no way, you cannot give away Jerusalem, you can't do anything, you cannot divide Jerusalem. Well, why not? According to this approach, why have you drawn that line there? You've said that other places, yes, Jerusalem, no. Is Jerusalem different? Well, yes, Jerusalem has a different Kedusha, but how does that work? Rav Jacobovitz has drawn his own line in a certain place. I'm going to leave you to read Rav Lichtenstein. Rav Lichtenstein he writes basically the Shita of Rav Soloveitchik, which again was that giving away land for peace is acceptable under certain circumstances. And this is a letter which was written to Rav Avram Shapira, who was the Rosh Hashiva of Merkaz Arav. And you'll see the arguments he brings. He brings Rav Soloveitchik, he raises Loi Techanim. He says that there may be a little hypocrisy when it comes to the Heter Mechira, where Loi Techanim is not a problem, but when it comes to land for peace, all of a sudden it is a problem. On the other hand, as you said, they are different. And I actually brought you the Shita of Rav Soloveitchik himself, which is recorded in Nefesh Arav, by Rav Shechter, 35, which again said that under certain circumstances it is definitely halakhically permitted to give away land for peace. And therefore, you see here a few different approaches. Basically, there are two schools of thought on this. There is a school of thought that clearly understands that we are in Akhalta de Gula, we're in a process of Reishit Smichat Gula Teinu, and with that territory, no pun intended, goes the idea that we cannot give away one clod of earth. Okay, not one piece of earth can be given away. There are any number of Torah mitzvahs that prohibit it. And anyway, the security situation makes it almost suicidal to even think of doing that. But there are other voices, and we've seen clearly Rav Shach, we've seen Rav Jacobovitz, we've seen Rav Soloveitchik, we see Rav Lichtenstein, who say, it's a lot pashut. If indeed there is a real military assessment that we can trust, and that becomes very difficult, how do you understand who to trust, that there is a real prospect for peace, then all of these issues, one after the other, halachic and hashkafic, can be dealt with and can be set aside, and land for peace becomes a real option halachically and hashkafically. The $64,000 question is who to believe on these issues, which is beyond me. But you see all the sources set out here. There may be other opinions as well. I'm sorry we've gone a minute or two over time. There's a lot of sources here to look at more, and I'm sure you'll look into this in your own time as well. Thank you very much. I wish you all a good day.